Welcome to Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tasha Chaparis. Joining me on the show this week for the first time is breaking news reporter Claire Ballard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And also breaking news reporter Naheed Rajwani.
Hello.
Later on the show, we're going to have reporter Diane Solis speaking to a Dallas-based attorney, Paul Zoltan, about a record backlog of pending immigration cases. We'll talk today about who won the fight for Dallas County Commissioner, a new task force taking a bite out of violent crime, and sadly, the death of a Euless police officer killed Tuesday in the line of duty. So without further ado, let's get started. First, we'd just like to update on the Dallas County Commissioner race. John Wiley Price won his ninth straight term in office, beating out former councilman Dwayne Carraway, even though John Wiley Price is facing federal corruption charges. His trial is set for September 6th, and our Naomi Martin actually wrote about that yesterday, saying that if he is convicted of his federal corruption charges, he will automatically be removed from office. So just wanted to update on that on Super Tuesday. Next, we'll talk about a new violent crime task force that Dallas Police Department announced yesterday. There will be 170 officers who will be targeting five specific areas to deal with a sharp increase in violent crimes this year. So they're going to focus on the Forest Audelia area, Five Points, Ross Bennett, Hampton Ledbetter, and Hatcher Syene.
Tasha, what do Dallas police expect will happen or come of this task force?
Well, basically, they are hoping that there will just be an increase of presence, you know, an increased presence of officers looking at what's going on in those areas. There will be gang units working, narcotics officers working, canine. It's basically just a reallocation of resources, essentially, where they're going to be doing their regular jobs, but then they will also be going out to these specific areas to try to reduce, you know, robberies, drug crimes, burglaries, just to reduce the spike in crime. So we just got news of that yesterday. We don't know a whole lot yet about how that will do, although they were pretty proud that within the first 2 hours they had already seized an assault rifle. So it looks like they're starting strong and should be going out. But we'll keep checking in on that to see how they do. So sadly, we're going to move on to the death of a Euless police officer. All three of us actually have kind of been working on that to some extent. Here's what happened. On Tuesday, three police officers responded to the J.A. Carr Park in Euless after reports of gunshots. Jorge Gonzalez fired on the officers, killing Officer David Hoffer. The two other officers shot and killed Gonzalez, whose family says that they believe he was high on meth at that time. There have been an outpouring of tributes for Officer Hoffer, who was fairly recently engaged to be married. And it's also said that he had always wanted to be a police officer. That was his goal in life. So, Claire, Naheed, can you tell us a little bit more about what happened?
Yeah, so from what we know, Jorge Gonzalez had a deep history of a deep criminal background and had been a drug addict for quite some time. His family told us that he started using methamphetamines from the age of 15. And really, they from what we know also, he had burglarized a home in the area where he had stolen weapons. And a call was made from a neighbor of the park saying that gunshots were heard, which is what officers responded to. His family has questioned why he was released so soon. His father had called the police on Monday saying that he had stolen money from him and was on drugs, and police responded and arrested him at that time. So his family was questioning why he was released when he was still on these drugs and coming down. Euless Chief Officer Mike Brown, his response to that was, Gonzalez did not appear to be on drugs when he was released, and he was pleasant to judges and accepted his sentence.
Right. He was given community service, which he agreed to.
Naheed,
you're familiar with Euless, and you were actually there Tuesday after the shooting. So can you speak a little bit about what the reaction was, how people are feeling, what you saw?
Yeah, actually, I'm kind of part of the community because I grew up in Euless and I still live near there. So it's been interesting to see how people have responded. For example, there's this statue that's right outside the police department, which is actually a really new police department. So it's very nice. And the statue is known like the Spirit of Care statue. And that really became kind of a focal point for memorial for this officer. And you could see people from across North Texas, including police officers from Dallas and McKinney and all these other cities coming by leaving flowers, or a lot of residents of Euless were coming by, and a lot of them, even you can tell on Facebook, they're just really upset by what happened. A lot of them were saying, you know, I'm crying, I can't stop crying about it, just hearing about what happened. And even driving by the police department, there's all these locally owned businesses, and a lot of their signboards said things like, you know, back the blue, or RIP Officer Hoffer hero. And these are basically local community members who have just been really taken aback by what happened. And you can really tell in the tone of these messages that are being sent towards Euless PD. And, you know, even the night of this incident, Baylor Medical Center Grapevine, there's all these officers from all over who had just driven over to the hospital basically to offer support. So when the fiance of this officer walked into the hospital, all of these officers stood by and just like were there in support. And one of them, he actually is now the spokesman of Grapevine Police Department. He said, you know, I was there for 6 years and I know what it's like to lose someone. He was around when an officer in Grapevine had been struck by an intoxicated driver. And so he said, as soon as I heard about this shooting, immediately I kept thinking about the early 2000s when one of my colleagues was killed. And immediately he drove over to the hospital just to be there for a few hours and be there for support and just to honor someone who died. Because a lot of these police departments, especially in the Mid-Cities area, they're small suburban areas, and they really do help each other out. So when something happens in a city like Euless, it's not unheard of for someone in Grapevine or Colleyville or Flower Mound or Coppell to just be around to help. And you can really see that this death has really like rocked that community, and I really mean that.
Right. They're all suburban communities, primarily residential. You know, in fact, I kind of wonder what the officers had expected to see, you know, Tuesday afternoon when they responded to that park, because as the chief was saying yesterday, the Gonzalez, he was kind of hiding in a drainage ditch and basically ambushed them, stood up and started shooting. So can you speak a little bit more about that, Claire, of kind of what it shows, what the investigation is showing so far?
Well, one thing, I spoke with a man who was in his driveway just across the street from the park when the shooting happened, and he's lived in that home for 35 years, and he said nothing of this sort has ever happened in this community like this before that he can recall. So not only to the officers working alongside Hoffer, but even to the surrounding community, this, like Nahid said, really shook their world. And I don't think that it didn't sound that officers were expecting to encounter what they did. And it was very uncommon to come up across someone with multiple weapons in a kid-friendly neighborhood park like this. And from what we know, Officer Hoffer saw movement in the drainage ditch and came forward giving verbal commands to the suspect to come out, and that's when the suspect then jumped up and essentially charged officers and fired multiple shots, one of which was the fatal shot that hit Officer Hoffer.
And there are schools in that area, too. So you hear stories of parents who are about to pick up their kids and they're standing in the driveway of the school and they hear this gunfire being exchanged. And it's interesting to hear that it wasn't just the people that were involved in this shooting or the ones that were living in that area. It was also just people who happened to be around who heard this gunfire wondering, what is going on? Like, I was in an interview nearby and I hear police cars. I'm in that interview and I hear sirens from police vehicles. And I'm wondering, like, okay, I'm sure somebody just died nearby or something has happened. I didn't think much of it until you see tweets or you see emails about, oh, by the way, there's this gun battle going on in Euless, and it's right. Something that you just don't expect to hear about until, and then you don't really understand the gravity of it until the police chief walks into the room in a news conference in at Euless Police Department and says, one of our officers has died. And that's when you understand that, like, this community is just not going to be the same for a while.
Yeah, I mean, we had heard that there was possibly an armed suspect and that there was a shooting, and but you don't expect that the police officer will be dead. I mean, you think that they'll be safe. I mean, as much as we know that they're putting their lives in danger, sometimes a situation like this really brings that home. And on that note, too, though, the family was really grieving yesterday. Unfortunately, there's a long history of kind of domestic violence within the family. Mr. Gonzalez had been arrested many times by ULIS police, often when he was high, and he would lash out violently. And it seems a lot of that violence was targeted at his sister, who you talked to yesterday, Claire. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about how she was feeling and kind of what her reaction was to it?
I think she was still in a state of shock as to what happened. It was clear, though, that their father, this had really hit him hard. He was struggling to speak with reporters as he was kind of moving through his grief. As for the suspect's sister, Jennifer Gonzalez, she's 17 years old and had always had a rocky relationship with her brother due to his drug use. And a lot of the charges against him for domestic violence were targeted at her. And I think because of that, she has had mixed feelings about everything that's happened. She was at school when it all happened, and when she saw on Twitter that there had been a shooting in her community, she jokingly said, "Oh, that's my brother," thinking he was still in jail. So it was clear that this behavior was not unusual from her brother, but she said she never expected it to go this far.
Right. He had been violent and, you know, paranoid within the family, but probably never thought that he would actually kill another person.
Right. And I asked her where she thought he would be if you rewound the clock and went back to when he was 15, before he started using these destructive drugs. And she said, to be honest, she thought he might be in the police force. He had a personality that fit it. It's something he had talked about that he wanted to do. And it's something that he completely lost sight of, she said, as these drugs started to take over his life. And up until the time of his death, he was fairly unrecognizable to his family.
Wow. That's a really sad deal all around. And of course, our thoughts go out to the ULIS Police Department after that. And they never expect to lose one of their own. So next, we'll go to our reporter, Diane Solis, who spoke earlier to immigration attorney. They speak about the record backlog of immigration cases in Dallas and how that's affecting the court system.
Hi, Paul.
Hello,
we're so glad that you joined us today. Paul Zoltan, who's a veteran immigration attorney here in Dallas and has led or co-led an effort to provide free legal help to many of the people who have come over from Central America, desperately fleeing the violence there. And Paul, we'd like to get into this massive backlog that we're seeing in the nation's immigration courts, nearly 500,000 pending cases right now. And it's perplexing because for outsiders, they'll say, well, hey, you know, I really feel like I'm up on immigration, and net migration from Mexico is actually down. So why do we have this backlog? What would you say, Paul?
Well, the chief cause is the arrival in recent years of a great many refugees from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras that have each been vying over recent years for the most violent nation on earth. The gang violence there has escalated to the point that the people are fleeing those countries in great numbers we haven't seen really since the civil wars in the 1990s. The trend over the past decade has seen the immigration court backlog triple, even as the government, unfortunately, the administrations past and present have had or devoted few resources to those immigration courts. The immigration court's budget amounts to less than 2% of the immigration enforcement budget at the federal level, and consequently, they have increased the number of immigration judges by a small fraction, even as their workload has tripled.
Yeah, and I looked into this in a piece that I did recently, and there are about 100 judges who are eligible for retirement. So there's a problem that can come rather quickly. And the funding for the immigration courts this past year, this current year, was about $421 million. And the budget request for the next fiscal year is $428 million. One of the things they want to do is improve electronic filing. It's my understanding that there isn't much electronic filing right now. I heard this several times from people I interviewed. I could hardly believe it. Is this really true, Paul?
Well, I'm a bit of a Luddite, so I can... I have to confess, I haven't filed anything electronically just yet.
Okay. Well, I'm told by one of the big bosses in the government, that a prosecutor, that he can't either. All right. You know, we hear a lot in the news, and particularly in this ferocious presidential cycle, about immigration and about border security. Over the last decade, we've doubled the number of boots on the ground. And yet you don't see the same thing happening in the federal immigration courts. Can you tell me why you think that's so? And also, how important are the federal immigration courts to the whole flow of who gets to stay in America lawfully?
Well, answering the first of those questions first, the number of boots on the ground has actually had a dramatic impact on the lives of my clients. I no longer see virtually ever someone who's crossed the border in the past 5 years, 10 years, who evaded Border Patrol. The dramatic thing I have seen, one of the dramatic trends I've seen, is that virtually all of my clients who have crossed the border recently are in removal proceedings. That is to say, Border Patrol found them, arrested them, and in most instances, they were found by an asylum officer to have a credible fear of persecution. Otherwise, they would not be in removal proceedings. The importance of immigration courts can scarcely be exaggerated. They are responsible for determining whether a recent arrival is a refugee, whether they're entitled to refuge in this country, whether there are other immigration benefits available to them, among them, rather than reciting the names, I'll just say that there are certain, our law gives expression to certain concerns. Those who have lived in the United States for a very long time and have behaved themselves well, and who can also show that their removal would cause exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to a U.S. citizen parent, child, or spouse, they are eligible to apply for a certain form of relief. But those, even though the defenses against removal are few and hard to obtain, it's very important that those who apply for them are given due process. That doesn't mean that they're entitled to drag things out. It's not the immigrants themselves that cause the delay. It's the lack of resources that are devoted to the courts that is causing these cases to drag out sometimes 2 years, even 5 years in length.
And with that kind of pause in the process, is it a good thing for people, or is it a bad thing?
It depends upon circumstances. For many people who frankly might are likely to be denied relief, such as asylum, those who have difficulty showing that they will be persecuted, as I'd like to say, for the right reason, which is to say those who will have difficulty showing that they would be persecuted for their race or religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or their political opinion. For those who have a compelling reason to fear returning to their country but can't tie that fear to one of those five protected grounds, frankly, it is not, I don't think anyone celebrates how long it takes for them to their cases to be adjudicated, but while they are waiting, awaiting a decision, they are safe. So certain ones among the immigrants in that backlog are not, they're not going to be cheering for more resources devoted to immigration judges. But I think that that the fact that we need more resources cannot be denied.
Immigration is a civil matter or a criminal matter?
Immigration is a civil matter, although the Supreme Court has acknowledged that in its consequences, it is in many respects similar to criminal cases insofar as the stakes are that high. There are many people who would rather be in prison than sent back to the countries they've come from, because at least in prison they would be safe.
Okay, and there are some instances under immigration law where it can rise to a criminal matter under the code if it's, for example, a reentry.
Yes, that's correct.
The government can elect to file a criminal charge, but they don't do it, my suspicion is, because they would clog the federal courts then.
Well, they actually, Diane, they already do. More than half of all federal enforcement resources are devoted to immigration-related cases. So that's more than racketeering and kidnapping and terrorism all added up.
And the last two or three years, I've sat in the federal immigration courts and witnessed so many people coming through, the children and the teenagers and moms from Central America with toddlers. And so many don't have attorneys. So what kind of challenge is that both for them and for people like you who have risen up and said, I will represent these people pro bono?
The establishment of the clinic at Catholic Charities, the Pro Se Asylum Clinic, owes to the concern attorneys cost a great deal, that the representation, adequate representation in immigration court requires a great deal of time, a great deal of expertise, and the cost for recently arrived mothers with children, unaccompanied children, is just, it's too great. And so it's imperative that that attorneys provide pro bono representation in compelling cases where the resources are simply unavailable. And one response, and another possible response to that need is to train volunteers, as we have done with Catholic Charities, attorneys among them, but volunteers who will prepare applications for asylum free of charge, or virtually so.
Okay. And a child or a teen who is unrepresented in the federal immigration court has a huge chance of being ordered to return to their country
of origin? Okay. Yes, the denial rates among the unrepresented immigrants is astronomically high.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
I want to once again thank Attorney Paul Zoltan and my co-hosts today, Claire Beller and Naheed Rajwani, and also Diane Solis for speaking to the attorney earlier. Remember, our show comes out every Thursday, so be sure to join us again next week. We're on iTunes, so subscribe to our channel. And tweet us at Texas Crime Cast. And also, remember to find more on all of our stories today and continuing coverage on DallasNews.com. Our producer today is Tommy Noel. I am Tasha Chaparis. Now, here is Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto. Take it away, Mike.
How could anyone not share the pain, pride, admiration, and love for a young man taken too soon with so much life ahead? Life and service were one to David Hofer, a ULIS police officer killed in the line of duty this week. He died because he put himself between peril and a public that might not always appreciate it. It's a sad reminder that no amount of thanks is enough for these first responders and their families. Only 29, he knew the risks of being on the job, yet he embraced it. He worked 5 years with the NYPD and 2 years in ULIS, a suburb near DFW Airport. He earned 8 letters of commendation and dozens of tributes and death. The contrast could not be sharper with the 22-year-old accused of killing Hofer. The suspect has a long criminal history, a meth addict who abused and stole from his own family. Still, his father blamed police for releasing his son from jail while still high. The 22-year-old stole guns and ambushed Hofer in a park. Other officers returned fire and killed the suspect. When it comes to police, the misdeeds of the few will never eclipse the sacrifices by the many. Officer David Hofer is a heartbreaking reminder of a life that mattered.